Figured I'd warn you, I'm out of my mind and out to California. That's Pine Grove. It doesn't really rhyme, but they make it work. I'm Blake Murphy. This is Jays Talk Plus. Jays dropped 2 of 3 on the weekend. Very fun one on Friday. They went 3-1. They get a good Jose Berríos outing. They get a George Springer leadoff home run, the 59th of his career. They get a Spencer Horwitz moonshot to right field as an insurance run. Vlad picks up a couple hits again. Saturday, a tougher one. They lose 1-0. Vlad extends his 22-game hit streak, but that's about all the offense the Jays can muster on Saturday. Good Yariel Rodriguez performance, but he falls to, I believe, 1-5 now because the Jays do not score runs when Yariel Rodriguez pitches, and pitcher win-loss records are not fair to the pitchers. Sunday, a little more straightforward. They lose 8-4. Chris Bassitt gives up a 6-run first inning. Some interesting comments after the game about the roof being closed versus open and maybe what he expected and how that plays differently. Either way, 6-run first inning. Jays can't work their way back. Lose 8-4. Varsho does homer, but Vlad's hit streak ends at 22 games. Luis De Los Santos had a nice game in that one. Sorry, bud. You are optioned to the minors, as he told reporters after the game. The expectation is that friend of the show, Will Wagner, will be joining the Blue Jays in Anaheim as they start a 3-set against the Los Angeles Angels. Not down at the ballpark this weekend and not in Anaheim for the Los Angeles Angels series is Keegan Mathieson. He is deep working on The Franchise, a book about the Toronto Blue Jays. He of MLB.com and BlueJays.com joins us now. Keegan, how we doing, buddy?
I'm doing good, Blake. That's my favorite intro yet. I'm not at the ballpark. I am not in Anaheim. This is a beautiful thing. It's been a good few days. I think I've left the apartment. Don't let me misrepresent myself. Left the apartment just once these last 4 days, which was to buy more beer. So I'm just happy to have somebody to talk to. This is a good morning.
It is. And this is, for those who didn't hear us talk about it last week, this is how locked in Keegan is. Obviously a good East Coast boy. We had the largest Ontario kitchen party on Saturday. Alan Doyle and Joel Plaskett and the East Pointers playing at Budweiser stage. And we couldn't even convince you to come out for that. That's how dialed in you are.
That was tough. That was as tempted as I have been. I knew that if I got off the rails once, I'd be off the rails for a few days. I was really locked in here. Even, goodness, about 30 minutes ago, before I quickly cleaned myself up and trimmed the beard, I looked like a guy who shouldn't be outside whatsoever. So this has really just been a great excuse for me to clean my act up, Blake. It's very rarely do I find one of those.
Yeah, glad one of us cleaned ourselves up for the show today. Keegan, okay, so obviously you're keeping an eye on the Blue Jays. You watch the games on the weekend as well. But before we get into some of that stuff, how is the book going? I don't know how much you care to divulge about what that book is going to be when it comes out in 2025 and stuff, but we've mentioned on the show a bunch how much work you're putting into it, how locked in you are right now on it. How's it going? What are you excited about?
It's going well. I'm finally near the end, which is starting to get fun again. It was fun when this all started, when I signed a contract and kept it as my secret for a while. The middle part where you have to do it, not as fun. But now we're getting to the end. I've got about 10,000 words left to write here, which will be maybe today into tomorrow. I've loved this. It's been fun to write about baseball in a way that does not require me to ask somebody why they sucked or gave up 3 home runs every night. It's very refreshing to talk to players, a lot of these guys, alumni or old coaches, executives, about the good days, about the glory days, about some other stories. There will be some unique chapters in there I think people will enjoy, maybe. But it's been a great process. I've liked using a different part of my brain a little bit. So by Wednesday night, this is off to the publisher for them to make me, clean me up and make me look smart. And next spring, everybody hopefully still cares about the Blue Jays by then, and it'll be out in the world.
Well, yeah. Well, hope springs eternal is the thing. And spring training baseball, the timing will be good. And yeah, it's nice that you have the editing help. I wrote a book without much editing help, and you can tell. So looking forward to that, man. You mentioned a little bit that change in like tact of how you're talking to players and the way you get to approach interviews and stuff like that. Not to get like nihilistic about it or like, hey, the 2024 season doesn't matter that much or whatever. But in terms of your own perspective, zooming out like that and looking at the history of the franchise, how has that shifted, you know, how you're handling the way 2024 has gone, if at all?
It's been very refreshing to step outside of the day-to-day. And I think even since the trade deadline, maybe even early July, Blake, I'm not covering a lot of hard detail baseball. If the Blue Jays win 4-3 or lose 5-2, often I don't care too much. It's not much about the standings at this point, but it's not caring at all. It's important to care. There's just as much stuff that's interesting right now. But if they lose 5-2 and Leo Jimenez drives in both of those runs, or Yariel Rodriguez, he's a guy who would pitch well and still end up losing 5-2 somehow. Spinning it into next year, I think, is what this is all about right now. And it's, I think, refreshing for a lot of people to be able to look into that future a bit. But going back through a lot of these alumni stories, even some recent stories, going back to write about Vladdy as a prospect, going back to write about the Shohei Ohtani pursuit, which I've had a lot of fun doing, it's fun to get outside of this day-to-day why things have gone wrong and look at seasons or events that went right for the Blue Jays. Kind of reminds you what it can feel like when this team is going well, because when this team is not going well and the dome is half empty and there's nothing to play for, it takes a bit of the spice out of it, you know. But when you're reminded of what this city looks like when it's really going, that perks you up a bit again.
Yeah, it certainly does, and it would be nice to get back there. I do wonder, you know, we heard Mark Shapiro talk about last week how there's a business impact to this, not to the extent that you expect payroll to change, but I do wonder, you know, it's season ticket renewal season. We wonder how that stuff materializes there. But no, that's helpful perspective. So here's a question then. Obviously the outcomes, you know, 4-3 loss, 4-3 win, as long as the key pieces play well, that's kind of the more important thing. When you looked at the schedule, and I'm sure you looked at the schedule when you picked which stretch of time you were going to take off to focus on the book, and they're playing 16 straight games against bad teams, how much have you thought, like, oh, you know what would be very in character for this team? To go on, like, a Raptors-style fake comeback and just, like, go 12. And obviously, they're not going to do that. But how much was it on your radar of, like, oh, yeah, they're going to pad this thing, the win-loss, in this stretch of Angels, Cubs kind of baseball?
That would be the way. The old down 10-3, but you lose 10-9. How nice was it that they clawed back? Yeah, who cares? It's that's on the mind as well. And it still creeps into your mind when you see this team win a few games, because everybody, when they win, looks good. You can't win and look bad. But the Blue Jays, when they win, it looks so good, because you see these pieces. You see Vladdy playing like one of the best players in the league. You see flashes of the old George Springer. You see Dalton Varsho being the best defender in the league. You see these little individual things that should still be fitting in a postseason run. And going back to the book, Blake, and kind of zooming out and looking at different seasons, I think it's made me appreciate how you look back on the missed opportunities. And we talk about these last few teams. I mean, the lineup in 2021, the pitching staff of 22, 23. It's going to be strange to look back on these years in a few years down the road, man. Looking at these rosters 10 years down the road, I mean, not the August roster of the Blue Jays, the opening day roster. But we're going to look back on this, and I think more often than not, think, what the hell happened?
Yeah, you're going to look and, the second best season of Vlad's career. They won 70 games. It's not going to be it's not going to be great. Now, it'll look one way if they turn it around and are good again next year. It'll look like a blip and a moment. But yeah, if this is the beginning of the end of this window or core or whatever, it's going to look very, very different. From a results perspective, I ask you this just because it's come up on Twitter a couple times recently, and I think it's like a little bit of the NBA / NFLification of late season. Yeah. The Blue Jays are seventh to last in the standings. They're fifth to last the fifth best lottery odds because the White Sox and Oakland can't jump up. How much are you keeping an eye on that? Like, this is a series with the Angels where they're only two games apart. They play them six times in the next 10 days or whatever. Like, are you keeping an eye on that? Or in baseball, is the lottery odds and the lack of immediacy of prospects, is that like too far of mind for you?
A little bit. Not quite the NFL where there's a number one quarterback coming down the line that's going to turn your franchise around tomorrow. Ideally, I like what the lottery has done in that sense. Similar to the NBA, I think we still talk about it more in the NBA because you're tanking for a Wembanyama or someone like that. But in baseball, it's got to start coming up. You need something to be happy about at this time of year, my God. And if you're the Blue Jays, you could very well be looking at that number 3, 4, 5, 6 pick next year. The Blue Jays have been stuck picking 18, 20, 22 for a few years now. And that's been part of the challenge to really rebuild this farm system, because the Blue Jays across the board, I think we've talked about this a lot, Blake, over the years, is they have guys, they have prospects. They've got a lot of number 15 and 16 prospects. But since Vladdy and Bo graduated, this organization has lacked that true star coming up. Looked like it would be Nate Pearson for a while. Looked like it would be Ricky Tiedemann. Looked like it would be Arelvis. It always looks like it's going to be somebody. But on top of producing players like Horwitz, like Davis Schneider, like Addison Barger, Leo Jimenez, you need to produce the odd Vladdy. You need to produce a star or two along the way. That's when this whole thing starts to work. And if the Blue Jays are able to get a top five pick, you don't want to be there, but you can make the most of it. Last time they did, they drafted Austin Martin, eventually dealt him in the Barrios deal. That's pretty good. That's a good deal. So that's a way to kickstart this farm system a bit, because even though they've added a lot of prospects, like 13 at the deadline, this farm system still needs help. It's still a bottom half, probably bottom third farm system, and no better way than picking up the top of the draft.
Yeah, it's. I mean, you can do the trade deadline moves and add the depth and through the middle part of it, and yeah. That's great. The Jays have more guys who could potentially play an okay second base and OPS 670 than any team could ever need. They got a lot of that type of guy, but yeah, the upside, we'll see. We'll see if like a Charles McAdoo can click or whatever. Yeah. Speaking of prospects, so I know at the beginning of the year on MLB Pipeline, you have a big hand in the top 30 Jays prospects entering the year. And that's cool because, I mean, I'm sure it's cool for you to get to do it. I know you're down at spring training watching these guys and talking to a lot of guys. There's this cool tool that I've told people about before where you can see the box scores of every Blue Jays affiliate every day, and the top 30 guys are highlighted, so you can kind of draw your eyes where they need to go. In season, when those things get updated, and they're going to be updated tomorrow night, I believe, on the Blue Jays side at MLB, you have less of a hand in it, right? Sam Dykstra kind of takes it from there in season?
That's right. That's right. Now, down in spring training, I'm there so damn long, they need to give me something to do. So I get us started with the top 30 list, and then Sam Dykstra and our MLB Pipeline team, who are fantastic at what they do, they take it over mostly through the chunk of the year. And I like when we do our first rankings. I know that it's a race to get rankings out earlier and earlier every year. I like at least seeing these guys. Oh, did he grow a foot? Is he 50 pounds heavier now? Does he have a beard? I mean, let me look at the guy first before we rank them every year, because these are 19, 20, 20-year-old, 21-year-old men who are still growing. There's still a physical aspect to all of this. So we get our original rankings out usually mid-March. And now finally we will have the big re-rank coming, not only with the players who the Blue Jays acquired via trade, which will really shake things up, I think, and also the draft prospects with Craig Savage getting in there as well, Cal Steven and the rest. So that'll shake it up a bunch. And it's made me appreciate a bit more, Blake, because the tough part of this, when you're covering a farm system that's not exactly the deepest or the best, is that when someone like Spencer Horwitz graduates out of the system, we're looking at this and thinking, man, oh man, who is number 30 now? We've got an empty spot. Who do we put on? Now the Blue Jays system, there's a more solid group of 10 or 12 beyond the top 30 who you're comfortable sliding on. So the depth, I think you can see how that has grown. But that's right. That'll be updated, I believe, tomorrow, and you'll be able to see a look at a lot of the big names that have been added. Bloss, Class A, some others.
Bloss, who made his debut with AAA Buffalo on Saturday, only threw 50 pitches, but a bit of a mixed bag. No earned runs, but didn't really miss a lot of bats or whatever, pitch to contact. We'll see. We'll have to get a longer look at him. Sam Dykstra is going to join us on the show Thursday. We'll talk about that a little more. And then one of these names is going to get real interesting by the time tonight comes around. So the Blue Jays have optioned Luis De Los Santos to the minors. They have not officially recalled Will Wagner, but the Buffalo Bisons put him in that generic changed roster status limbo that you can be in AAA sometimes. Will Wagner's getting called up tonight. It sure seems. What are you looking for from Will Wagner when he, if we'll say he joins the Blue Jays tonight in Anaheim?
Yeah, if. Will Wagner is a very Blue Jays player, not just because he has a famous father in Billy Wagner, but his position, his offensive profile, is a guy who makes a ton of contact with a really good approach, takes a ton of walks. So I think we have a similar conversation with Will Wagner, Blake, that we would have with someone like Spencer Horwitz almost. Maybe there's a bit more pop in there with Will Wagner, a bit more defensive versatility involved. Maybe Will Wagner can grow into what the Blue Jays had envisioned for Cavan Biggio. I don't mean this year Cavan Biggio getting DFA'd, but what the Blue Jays envisioned over the years for Biggio, which would have been an extremely valuable role. And what I look for with Wagner is the same thing I look for with Clement, with Schneider, going down the list with Horwitz, with Barger. You want something to pop out. What is going to make him more than just another depth piece, another guy who can play the infield on this team? For him, it looks like a really, really good plate approach, something in the direction of a Spencer Horwitz. And if you can stack a few of those guys together, fantastic. Get more guys on base for Vladdy, for George Springer, ideally another power hitter on this roster next year. But you're looking for something to pop out of that, because I don't think Major League Baseball is going to overwhelm a guy who's been around it. We've seen that with Bo, seen that with Vladdy. But I'll watch him very similar to Horwitz, how he's going to handle that and how much power he can add to have something pop, something stand out.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to watch. And by all accounts, the second base play is all right. That's where Buffalo played him. I'd imagine that's where the Jays are going to primarily play him, although he has played a little third, a little first, a little short. Again, typical Blue Jays kind of guy here. Yeah. And yeah, I mean, he's 26, so you don't, it's similar to Spencer Horwitz. Like, you're not looking at the AAA performance and being like, yeah, oh my God, I'm projecting the world on top of that. Like, if you're 26 and at AAA and have a major league potential, like, you should be doing it. But more walks than strikeouts, pretty good line drive rate, not a boatload of home runs, but a good amount of doubles and things like that. It's, again, it's a Blue Jays type of guy, certainly. On the other side of this, poor Luis De Los Santos was in the organization for like 35 years. Finally gets the he was signed out of the Dominican in 2015. I'm exaggerating a bit, but almost a decade in the organization, kind of slotted in as like org depth guy, which is not an insult. Yeah. Like, a lot of guys don't make it to that, but like, yeah, you're the guy losing out on playing time at AAA if there are too many prospects concentrated there, right? Like, mm-hmm. when Horwitz and Addison Barger and Aurelvis Martinez were all there with AAA, you know, maybe you're the guy losing out. He comes up, he goes 2-for-7 in his little bit of window of opportunity, and now he's back down, and who knows if and when we'll see him again. You feel for a guy like that? Like, obviously there are guys like this who pop up every year on every roster, and it's part of the life, and you're a major leaguer now, but I kind of feel for him, man.
Oh, absolutely. You look back at these guys who have really grinded it out in an organization. For whatever reason, Vinny Capra is coming to mind a couple of years ago, a guy who had been around forever. Coaches, teammates just loved. And De Los Santos, I believe, going back July 2015, signed the same day as Vladdy with the Blue Jays. Not as big a name, but consider that. Vladdy's been in the league 5 years. All five of those years after climbing up, De Los Santos has still been in the minor leagues. And exactly like you said, Blake, he's the guy who they would move around other higher-ranked prospects. That's kind of who David Schneider was for years in the minors, too. If there was a big second-base prospect, tough luck. You don't get to play second base for 2 months. De Los Santos, I do love those stories. And a season as bad as this allows for a few of those stories. Glad he got that base hit down the line as well. So there was a real hard hit, legitimate base hit in there as well. A guy like that, you hope comes back. It is better to have touched the major leagues once than not at all. But man, getting back into the clubhouse, I know our friend Julia Kreutz, she was interviewing him, and when she found out that he was getting optioned, she said he was holding the lineup card. It's just it's a bit tragic. It's cruel how Major League Baseball happens, but it marches on, and good on him for giving that hit, but hopefully he gets another chance, and he's been a guy that's been around forever.
Yeah, well, I mean, look, it's a tough spot to be in. Vinny Capra played for the Pirates last year and played for the Brewers earlier this year. Otto Lopez plays like semi-regularly for the Marlins, which tells you a lot about the Marlins, but also like once your foot's in the door, like there's a potential for you there. And it's not like, you know, it's a lock that everyone's going to be healthy the rest of the way here. It's maybe a little early for this with Class A and Nathan Lucas having just started a rehab assignment, but your sense that maybe Stuart Brough is going to end up being in that kind of spot as well. Like, if the Jays want to get a look at someone else the rest of the way here, I guess we're only a couple weeks from rosters expanding, but I'd imagine Brough is in maybe a similar spot given how little they've used him.
Yeah, the Blue Jays haven't really prioritized his playing time. It's kind of my dream job. Like the Blue Jays fourth outfielder, 26th man, they just don't use the guy.
Bradley Zimmer.
I don't care who it is. Exactly. Lucas was that for a while last year. They just don't use the guy. Jordan Luplo was that for a while last year. It's the backup quarterback of the Toronto Blue Jays. Class A is the one I'm really excited to see because there's incredible upside there, athletically, defensively, especially if he can tap into his power a little bit more and make contact. If you get a guy on base that stole 79 bases in the minor leagues last year, that's exciting. That's an element this Blue Jays team doesn't really have. Now, with that comes incredible risk, of course, but this organization is stocked to the gills with prospects, like we just talked about, Blake, who look the same in terms of a profile, who can play second base, who do the same thing offensively. Class A, kind of like Charles McAdoo, who came over in the IKF deal from Pittsburgh, offers more athletic upside. McAdoo with some power, Class A with his athleticism, and defense, certainly. Left field next year is wide open. Dalton Varsho is the center fielder now, where he should be forever. Is that going to be Loperfido? Well, it hasn't looked great so far. He'll get lots of tries. Could it be Class A? Well, maybe. This is a guy with the upside that the Blue Jays need to look at, I think, in the major leagues this year. And the sooner the better for that down the stretch. It's going to be interesting as well, Blake, and all of this, how they manage George Springer's reps down the stretch. Do you keep Dalton Varsho off his feet a bit? Same for the rotation. Some of those kind of uncomfortable conversations coming as well.
Yeah, Varsho, I mean, you got to pad his stats for the Gold Glove now that we know he's going to qualify as center field, not left field. You got to be a little careful there. Make sure, with the weird statistical component of that, you want him in there. Yeah. But yeah, those are good questions, especially on the pitching side. What are your initial Loperfido impressions here? Obviously, he's a pretty well-liked guy, but similar to Wagner, like he's 25. He's done it at AAA. Like, this is his test time, tiny sample, but it has not gone super well at the dish yet.
Yeah, I think you need to see stats pretty soon. Now, it's not a immediately or you're gone type of situation. But if Loperfido, like Wagner, if they were 21 years old, you can look at a 1-for-19 stretch. You can look at the play folks are watching right now where he cuts in front of Dalton Varsho. Don't do that. You can look at that and say, okay, learning experience, let's go from here. Once a guy gets to be 24, 25, 26 years old, you need to start seeing the results play out. Now, we're also sitting in a city here that has known Jose Bautista and Edwin Encarnacion, a lot of these late bloomers. But when you have such a system that is coming in really in one wave with others like Jimenez, with Horwitz, with Barger, it's a bit of an open tryout right now. And the Blue Jays do need to see an element of current on-field production pretty quickly. Loperfido was a very exciting piece to get for the Blue Jays. That has not changed in 13 or 14 days. But this is a big stretch run for him because the Blue Jays need to decide how they view left field entering next year. Do they think they can let Loperfido and Class A kind of duke it out there, maybe with some David Schneider mixed in as a reserve? Or do they think they need to go out and spend 10, 15, 20 million bucks to fix that with a bat? That impacts absolutely everything else. So they need to figure that out these last 2 months. And it's a big decision because that's where you could upgrade your offense.
It is. And like, yeah, maybe one of the left field, third base, second base, DH, maybe one of those, you're like, okay, we got enough pieces. We got enough guys that we could try that out. But you can't go into the year with Loperfido and Class A as your left field. You can't go into the season with Clement and Jimenez and as your possible third base, Horwitz and Schneider as your second base. Like, some of these guys are going to lose out. Like, some of these guys are going to be AAA depth. They're going to be a 26-year-old AAA outfielder waiting for the call. So a lot of pressure there. Keegan, this one is maybe a little less important, but the Blue Jays are going to have an entire bullpen to change over. They've been doing the 40-man churn, adding guys here and there. Luis Frias, the latest one. I would imagine they'll claim Nick Robertson, who the Cardinals DFA'd yesterday and has better stuff than any of these guys that they're churning there. Whether it's one of those guys or someone else who's in the system, a Cook, a Fluharty, Hagen Danner started a rehab assignment on the weekend. Is there anyone in this relief pitcher churn the rest of the way that you want eyes on and you think the team's going to want to get a look at the major league level?
I think you just take swings on stuff at this point. Roll the dice over and over and over again. That's the unfortunate beauty of where the Blue Jays are at. If you roll the dice on four guys and they all suck, but the fifth guy is good, great. you win. And the Blue Jays going down through their system. I would like to see Hagen Danner. He did come up and I believe got injured immediately last year. So he's another kind of De Los Santos example who I hope can come up and do this on his own terms. He's a guy who I think would have gotten an opportunity if he had been healthy and pitching even okay. Cook and Fluharty, who you mentioned, a lot of these guys coming through. You look at Burr, you look at Little, all of these arms the Blue Jays are trying. If you throw a clean inning with two strikeouts, you're going to get to pitch tomorrow. This is Little League tryout time in the bullpen. And outside of Chad Green and I guess Enesis Cabrera, they are really just handing the ball to anyone at this point. This cannot be fun for John Schneider. I do not envy him when it comes past the sixth inning, especially Blake, if they need to start limiting some of these starters to limit their workloads later in the year.
Yeah.
But it really is tryout time, and you're going to roll the dice as many times as you can on guys that have stuff and hope that you strike gold. If you can find one or two guys to carry into next year, going back to the money of it all, maybe that saves you $3 million, $4 million here and there instead of signing depth options. But my God, next year they need 4, 5, 6 relievers.
Yeah, and there's going to be a huge 40-man crunch if a bunch of these guys will get non-tendered or waived in the offseason. Who knows? Even if you lose out on the position player battle, maybe you're a trade candidate to add to the bullpen that way and stuff like that. You're not going to Yeri Rodriguez your way to a full bullpen, even if, like you said, one of these guys clicks here. Last one before I let you go. On that note about pitchers getting, you know, if they ease back on the innings and things like that, that's probably, like we asked John Schneider about this on Friday. And he basically said those guys want to go out there and they want to pitch and they want to do their between starts work. I would imagine come September, the longer view takes a little bit of hold there. Would your lean right now be, hey, Jake Bloss is in there and they go to a six man? Or do you know, are we doing shorter outings and it's a deepened bullpen? Kind of some combination of both, like Bloss being added, and it sounded like from Schneider's chat, like they would add Bloss as a starter, not as a reliever. I guess you could bounce Bowden or Yariel to the bullpen, but seems like a six man's possible here later in the year.
Yeah, it depends on how many intact elbows the Blue Jays can find.
Don't
in
do
the
that.
System. This would have been a beautiful time for Ricky Tiedemann. This would have been a beautiful time for a lot of these pitching prospects who the Blue Jays have struggled to keep healthy this year. It's really unfortunate, especially with Tiedemann's case. Low stakes down the stretch. This really could have lined up well for him, and it's too bad that it hasn't. But I like the idea of Bloss in a six-man, and I do think the Blue Jays should at least talk about and explore, they surely will, how far they're going to push guys like Berríos, Bassett, who throw this many innings every single year. Now, I do not want to be the guy to have that conversation with them, especially Chris Bassett.
But good luck.
I think no, thank you. But I think it could be beneficial to this team. It's just about finding guys other than Bloss. And I would really like to see Bloss if the Blue Jays think he has those innings left. But beyond that, you're looking at Paolo Espino, some AAA guys. It's not really getting into your top prospects as you'd hoped. Chad Dallas, if he'd been having a stronger season, might be an option. Could still be, but the Blue Jays don't have that immediate AAA depth. Seeing more of Bowden Francis is certainly something I'm looking forward to. I'd love to see Bloss, but it's a tricky battle of filling those innings. Maybe Ryan Yarbrough, I guess, welcome to the Blue Jays. How many innings can you throw in 1 month?
Yeah, a lot. A lot, I hope. Look, and this is the thing, is like, even if Berríos and Gausman and Bassett are competitors and they feel healthy right now, I just brought up the leaderboard. Since 2021, so let's ignore the pandemic-shortened season. Since 2021, the last four seasons, Berríos, Gausman, and Bassett rank 5th, 6th, and 8th, respectively, in innings pitched all across baseball. Some guys can, like, Aaron Nolan, Corbin Burns, Zach Wheeler, Luis Castillo, like those are guys, and a huge chunk of the value is in being able to go out there and do it every fifth day in an era where not everyone does that. But it, A, highlights how big the workload has been for those guys, and B, highlights how much the Jays have kind of squandered having three workhorses at the same time, and Kikuchi, who's been pretty durable as well.
Yeah, those are scary numbers. 30 years ago, Blake, if we were talking on old-timey radio, I'd be saying, hell yeah, those are starters. Those are real pitchers. Nowadays, I look at those numbers and it makes me a bit nervous, especially as they try to compete into next year. This team has been very fortunate with health, and credit to those pitchers for staying healthy. One of these years, we keep saying it, they're going to need 10 starters. And when those numbers keep climbing, it does make you nervous. So they got an opportunity to kind of ease that off, let these guys rest a little bit. you and I can pitch, whoever, doesn't matter, but you got to protect them a little bit.
I was down at Christy Pitts yesterday watching the IBL Toronto Maple Leafs, and look, their starter went 6+ in that one. Sign him up. Keegan, speaking of big workloads, I know you got like 10,000 more words to bang out, so I'll let you go here. Thanks for taking the time.
Hey, you got it, buddy. We'll see you soon.
Keegan Mathison of MLB.com, of BlueJays.com. Make sure you're keeping an eye on his socials as well for updates about that book, which will be out in early 2025. Let's take a break. Let's go around baseball a little bit. We'll talk to Manny Randhawa of MLB.com, Brendan Wiley of The Score, and Sam Blum of The Athletic. We'll sprinkle some Jays stuff in there. Take a look at the Red Sox, the Angels, of course, who the Jays begin a three set with tonight. 9:38 start time for all three of these. So, get that third or fourth coffee in you before game time. Bowden Francis against Davis Daniel tonight. We'll fill you in on Davis Daniel a little bit as well. All that's next as Jays Talk Plus gets rolling on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Dive deep into Toronto sports and the NFL. The J.D. Bunkus Podcast. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. Again, Jays dropped 2 of 3 on the weekend. So if you thought maybe they'd go on a fake comeback run with 16 straight against teams under 500, they do not appear set to do that. It was an interesting stat coming into this series where if you look on the MLB standings page, you can look at teams' records against teams above 500. The Jays, of course, not very strong. They're 36-51 against teams against 500. The more interesting part of that is that the Blue Jays have played the most games against teams above 500. Now, part of that is even with the more balanced schedule, part of that is being in the American League East. Part of that is randomness. The Jays are in a 2-week stretch here where they only play bad teams so that the rest of the league will catch up to them. And then part of it is also there's always a quirk in strength of schedule where the worse the team you are, the more you're playing better teams because you've given them wins and stuff like that. If the Orioles have faced fewer 500 teams because the Orioles are not playing against the Orioles, whereas the Jays don't get to play the Jays, which hurts their strength of schedule. Anyway, all of that is to say, as funny as it would be if the Jays went on like a 15-1 run here or a 14-2 run here or something like that, it doesn't seem all that likely. Also, there's some fans would probably like that. It's more entertaining. The baseball games would be fun. But there's also draft to consider, even with MLB having a lottery system now and where, it takes prospects a couple years to make it. One thing you could do if you are an MLB team and you're drafting is just draft a guy named Jackson. Our next guest, Manny Randhawa of MLB.com, wrote about three young Jackson prospects all killing it in the majors at the same time. Manny joins us now. Manny, how we doing, buddy?
Hey, thanks for having me. How you guys doing?
Good, man. So let's start with the Jackson guys. I mean, it's an amusing thing. Like, I think everyone saw a Baseball Reference tweet out the other day that there are now more Jackson first names in baseball than Jackson last names. I don't have a good explanation for this. Like, my thought initially was like, okay, Sons of Anarchy was really popular for a minute, the main guy's name, but that didn't come out until 2008. So there was some sort of Jackson-related boom even earlier than that. What do we make of this, man? Like, the three best-hitting prospects and best-hitting rookies in the league right now.
Yeah, it's crazy, man. I mean, like, we're talking 2002, 2003, something like that. I mean, I don't know. I wonder if everybody got together like, you know what? Here's what we're going to do. We're going to name all our kids Jack, all our boys Jackson, and they're all going to make the big leagues and around the same time, obviously. And then they're all going to be like the three youngest players in baseball at the time. And they're all going to be super hyped prospects, and they're going to be really good in the big leagues. It wasn't smooth sailing, right, for everybody, like right. Jackson Holliday. Obviously, he was the most hyped of the three, comes up, and number one prospect overall still is, according to MLB Pipeline. And he comes up and goes, two for 34. So, it's not always the honeymoon phase that, like, everybody, expects and wants to see. And you know what? Plenty of greats have had that happen where they start off, they either have to get sent back down to AAA or whatever happens. But now, I mean, look at what's happened since he's come back on July 31st, man. He said, I guess he's got five homers now, and he hit another one Saturday. He's made American League history by becoming the youngest to homer in three straight games. He hit a grand slam for his first home run. I mean, there's just it's starting to show with Holiday, and then obviously Churio, you know, getting the $82 million extension before the season starts. It's like, well, you know, the Brewers really believe in this guy, and for good reason. Now we're seeing why. He's starting to produce, and then of course Jackson Merrill. Man, I mean Jackson Merrill. You know, there wasn't much slug in the first half, but man, the second half he has been tremendous. And he said, I think five game tying or either game tying or walk off homers. I think one of them was a walk off, and then like four of them have been game tying homers in the eighth or later, including on Saturday, helping fuel this incredible Padres run. I mean, they lost yesterday, but they're putting the heat on the Dodgers now. You know, and it's getting really interesting in the NL West.
Yeah, it's cool to see all three of those guys. And like, you know, we joke about all the parents sitting down with the name Jackson. Well, Jackson Holliday's parents did sit down. We're like, he is going to be a Major League Baseball prospect. His brother's going to be the top pick in the 2025 draft, maybe. But you're right. Yeah, it's been cool. You know, he's still only 20. He comes back. If Mike Trout can get sent down at some point, anyone can get sent down and then eventually figure it out. I think 167 weighted runs created plus since he came back up. And then Merrill and Churio, I mean, Merrill's probably had the best offensive season of the three of them. And then Churio with the defense as well. It's cool. And maybe the most fun part about this, other than the fact that all three are hot in August, is all three could be headed to the playoffs. And this isn't really about the Jackson part of it. Like, that's just a funny little side note. But three of the absolute top offensive prospects in baseball, position player prospects, are all contributing at age 20 or barely 21, in the case of Merrill, to serious playoff races. And that is, you know, Jackson of it aside, can't remember the last time three rookies on the position player side were this important to their respective playoff races.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, you look at the Orioles and the Brewers are both in first place. Now, the Orioles are dead heat with the Yankees, but the Brewers are certainly, you know, sitting pretty. I think they're seven plus games over, you know, ahead in the NL Central, so they're going to be in the postseason. Orioles will be in the postseason. The Padres are, you know, who knows, they might even win the West. Imagine a World Series where you got the Orioles and the Padres, and you've got Jackson Merrill on one side of things, and you got Jackson Holliday on the other, and they're coming up in clutch situations. And coming through and delivering under the bright lights of October. I mean, it's just the perfect scenario where you've got these 21-year-old kids who are, you know, they were in the minors, you know, very recently. In fact, in high school very recently. And, you know, suddenly they're in the World Series playing against each other. It's a very distinct possibility, and it's really exciting to think about, for sure.
It is. It's a lot of fun there. And then, by the way, Jackson Jobe, one of the best pitching prospects in baseball. Yeah. Also coming in with that name. He's in the Tigers organization.
That's the cool thing about baseball, though, right? Like, these kinds of weird things happen. I mean, whether it's regarding names or whether it's regarding some others, you know, something else is a coincidence. You know, they're just so it's so interesting, and it's kind of off the wall. You wonder that it's not a coincidence. So it's fun.
Yeah, it is. It's a lot of fun. Okay. Let's pivot off of those guys. Let's look around Major League Baseball a little bit. So, you are Colorado based. So you have an eye on a Rockies team that is not good necessarily, but as a fantasy player, deep appreciation here for Brenton Doyle. The season he's already a 2020 yeah. guy. He's gunning for 30-30. I mean, he's going to be in the mix for a gold glove, I think, too, maybe, given some of the defensive metrics. Just how much has he impressed you this year? I know he was like a guy coming into the year, but he is, like, I think at 26, established himself as like probably a pretty big piece of what the Rockies are going to do moving forward.
Absolutely. Him and Ezekiel Tovar are the guys I think that you finally see emerging as, you know, pieces that you can look at if you're the Rockies and say, okay, these are going to be part of the core that we can build around moving forward. Brenton Doyle has had an incredible transformation at the plate. He won a gold glove last year. He was tremendous defensively in center field. Super, I mean, he's fast. He's very fast. He's going to steal you 30 or 40 bags a year. That's the type of player he is on the base paths. But the offense was lacking tremendously last year. I talked to him just about 3 days ago, just asking him about, you know, how has he been able to sustain this? And he said that really it's a matter of, it's very simple. He's just he didn't have a whole bunch of movement in his stance last year, as far as his head and his hands, but he's kept everything very quiet this year, very, very quiet. And that's really helped him keep his head steady, keep the sequencing right between his heads and his hands, and his step toward the pitcher in terms of getting his foot down. And it's just been incredible. The guy's 20-20. I said, what about through a 30-30? He's like, yeah, for sure. That's definitely in play. This guy could be a 30-30 guy after, you know, he was a well below average hitter in his rookie season. And the man can just flat out play center field. And to play center field in such a cavernous park as Coors Field,
yeah,
especially in center, I mean, it's a Grand Canyon. I mean, there's so much ground to cover. They've been looking for this guy defensively for years and years, and they finally found him. And last year, the question was, can he hit enough to justify playing him out there? And now he's become this kind of five-tool guy that's really put it all together. So this guy's definitely a future all-star, multiple-time all-star. This is really who he is at the plate.
Okay, so I'm fairly convinced that Brenton Doyle is a guy, someone with the Rockies that I can't get a hold of. And it's always tough to tell Rockies pitchers generally. This year in the bullpen has been very funny with Beeks and Lawrence, and a couple other guys have come in and closed for a minute and then been gone. Victor Vodnik has been pretty up and down. I mean, 62 innings already as a reliever with a sub-4 ERA at Coors. You've got my attention. I know he had a very up and down weekend with a blown save and then a really good save. What do we make of where Victor Vodnik is? You know, I guess if you're going to create a Coors Field pitcher, a guy who can at least keep the ball on the ground helps.
Yes, a guy who keeps the ball on the ground, throws 100 so he can miss bats, has pretty good secondary stuff, slider. He's starting to throw the changeup a little bit more as well. So Victor is a guy who seems to be very even keeled. Like, he blew a save last week where he had a few good outings in a row, and they've been giving him more high leverage situations. We talked to Bud Black, the manager. He said, you know, as we've been giving him more high leverage situations, he's been more calm, more poised on the mound. And even when he blew that save, he comes right back and he picks up a couple of saves over the weekends. But, you know, yesterday was a big one. I mean, they scored 7 runs late in the 8th inning to come back and beat the Braves, who are reeling at the moment. And so that was a big moment for him. He showed a lot of emotion after picking up that save with the strikeout at the end. He's got good stuff. He's got very good stuff. And I think he's starting to mature to the point where, yes, he has the poise, he has the calm, but he also, the way he likes to talk about it, he's like, I just need to know, you know, I gotta have that dog in me, but I need to know when to, like, you know, when to have that come out. I think that he's figuring that part of it out. And I think he could be a guy. I mean, he could be, again, just like in center field, the Rockies are trying to figure out the back end of that bullpen, because their bullpen has been brutal this year. And it's been their weakest point. And they're trying to figure that out. To have a guy like that, if you can step up with the back end and you can start building that bullpen up around him, that's huge for them. And so it's going to be interesting to watch him toward the end here.
So with this Rockies team, it's been this will be 6 years in a row without a playoff appearance. You know, we know that they can have some fun there. Like, anyone my age remembers Rocktober. Obviously they were back in the playoffs for a little bit there, 2017, 2018. It's been a tough go though, these last, so what is the path back or the timeline back? And I know you wrote a great piece with insight from Kyle Freeland, who's been here through a lot of this. What does that path back look like right now?
Well, you know, one thing about the Rockies, I think since the Arenado story, era, which was, you know, now, boy, it's been about three or four years now since both of them have been gone. And we know how that ended. It was not pretty. It was difficult for the Rockies. And I think that they've been kind of looking for a new identity ever since then. And right now, and that's why Brenton Doyle and Ezekiel Tovar and potentially Nolan Jones, I mean, he's had back problems, had injuries, hasn't had a chance to really get going this season. He's supposed to be back pretty soon from his rehab with the back injury. But you finally have guys who are starting to emerge as the young players of the next window of contention in the future. And I think that and I think that position player-wise, you're starting to see that. Charlie Condon, you know, when they – when they drafted him third overall, I think there was a lot of excitement around here that maybe you're starting to think about bringing back the old school kind of Blake Street Bombers. Let's bludgeon these guys to death, you know, the opposing teams to death when they come to Coors Field, and let's make this place truly, let's own this place and make it our real home field advantage. But I think that the pitching side of things is where you're going to have to really, they're going to have to really solidify things. And that's, I mean, you've got Marcus coming back next year. You hope everything's okay with him. He's got a stress fracture. Let's be clear. It's a stress reaction to very different things in his elbow. And so he's shut down for the season. So, but he should be back healthy next year. Antonio Sensatella is on a rehab assignment. He's going to be back soon. And Kyle Freeland, when he's healthy, he's good. He's not Kyle Freeland in 2018 when he finished fourth in the Cy Young voting. But he's also not the guy in 2019 that got demoted to AAA. So he's going to be solid for you. That guy's got a chip on his shoulder. He knows how to pitch in Denver. He's a Denver native. You hope Chase Dollander, you know, their top prospect in the minor leagues, who people, you know, were comparing this guy before he kind of dropped in draft stock. They were comparing this guy to like a Jacob DeGrom type of pitcher. That's the type of stuff he's got and how he attacks you. And so he's been showing it in the minor leagues. It's a big difference, a big jump to the major leagues. But if he can turn out to be someone who is reliable and a good, you know, what they hope that he can be. Plus, Gabriel Hughes has been hurt. A lot of their pitching in the minor leagues is hurt and is on the way back. Everything is going to depend on what those guys can do, whether they can pan out. I think personally that they need to go back to that style of Blake Street Bombers. I think they need to go back to win 55 to 60 at home every year, because you know you're going to lose a lot on the road, because it's just physics. You go on the road. You can go throughout Rocky's history. You can go back to the Bombers. You can go back to Matt Holliday, Carlos Gonzalez, Trey Tulowitzki. All those teams, regardless of who they had, it wasn't personnel that was a problem on the road, because they all lost on the road. I think they had three winning seasons on the road. And those are only like 41 or 42 wins. So almost 500. So the idea, I think, is to go 500 on the road and win 55 to 60 at home and go into the postseason and figure it out. I wrote a book about the Blake Street Bombers, and I was talking to John Smoltz, and something that stood out to me about him, because it was the 95 postseason when the Rockies made their first postseason. It was their third year. And it was like, wow, this is a third year team. They're in the postseason already. What's going on? And Smoltz said the Braves, the Atlanta Braves, the team in the 90s, was legitimately worried about the Colorado Rockies and facing them in the first round, that weird 2-3 format back then, where you had to go to the lower seed for two games and then play three games at home. In the first year of the wild card, and they were legitimately scared of that lineup. He said, I don't know which lineup was better, Cleveland, but with Tommy and Albert Bell and Kenny Lofton and all those guys,
or the Rockies, Bichette,
Larry Walker, Andres Galarraga, all those guys. And I'm like, really? That I kind of asked him, like, that's interesting to hear you say. I mean, that's a little surprising. Like, but you give them a DH, and I don't know who's better. And they really prepared us for the World Series that year against Cleveland. And, you know, obviously they finally won the World Series. But the Rockies, I think of those times, really the idea was to just keep them within a few runs late, have a starting rotation that doesn't look at their ERA, keep them within a few runs, have a bullpen that's not afraid, and they're going to come back and win. So it was a different time, pre-Humidor, I get it, all of that. But I think that may be the way to go. And, you know, if you've got Michael Tolia, who's starting to come around a little bit, he's hit 20 home runs, or I guess he's at 19 home runs. He had a 3 home run game in New York. He's a guy that if he starts to actually put things together like this on a consistent basis, he could be a guy as well. So, you know, and you add Nolan Jones into the mix and you add Brent Doyle, you might have the makings of something like that. And I think that's what you got to do. So the pitching, though, it's always been an issue, and they're going to have to figure that part out. And hopefully these guys, the best pitchers in their farm system, will pan out. That's the key for them.
The book, by the way, is called The Blake Street Bombers, if anyone wants to read more about that era of Rockies. That was, I mean, yep. If you're my age and they're a new team and everyone hits a ton of home runs, those teams were a blast. And then obviously a Jays connection, yeah, with Dante Bichette having been on those teams as well. Manny, I'm going a little long with you here, so I apologize for that. But I did want to also I did want to just note, too, that the Rockies not having I know you mentioned the humidor, but like in the analytics era, the Rockies being behind on what Coors Field does to pitchers and stuff like that is at least mildly amusing to me, if not frustrating. Before I let you go, I did want to ask you about a terrific piece you wrote talking to Dave Dravecki and his fight with cancer and his return to baseball. What made you want to dive into that, and how much did it mean to you to be able to share Dave Dravecki's story like that to the MLB.com audience?
It was great. Dave is a wonderful guy. We talked, I think, all together between phone calls for like 2 hours. And I mean, I think a lot of people from that era know his story. And I just want to kind of put a different twist on it and a different kind of angle on it to kind of show folks just how incredible that story was, where, I mean, this guy is one of the better pitchers in the league, left-handed pitcher, and he has cancer, a very rare cancer in that left arm. And so, I mean, just the story is, I mean, incredible, because he loses 50% of that deltoid muscle up here. Doctors basically said, there's just no way you could do this. I talked to Mike Kruko, who that was his last year with the Giants. Now, obviously, he's with Dwayne Kuiper, and they're a great broadcast team for the Giants out there. But he said that we knew he wasn't coming back. There was just no way. And it was just emotionally devastating for obviously him, but also for the team. And he's back in less than a year on the mound in August of 1989. He then 5 days later breaks his arm in Montreal, throwing a pitch to Tim Raines. And, you know, that was the last time he threw a pitch. Because of that, and because he lost his arm after that, he's been an inspirational speaker ever since. And he started his own foundation, and that helps cancer patients and other people dealing with debilitating diseases and just painful situations. And he's just been an inspiration to people around the world. And I just wanted to kind of bring that story back now 35 years later, just to keep it in for, you know, to jog the memory of people who kind of were around at the time, but also to introduce a new generation to that story. And to this day, we just still don't really know how he did that, because there's no, Kruko said, you know, there's no doctor that could tell you how he did that medically speaking, but he did. He was able to come back in that first game against the Reds at Candlestick Park. You know, he gave up 3 runs in 8 innings, and he actually retired 14 of the first 15. He was throwing a shutout into the 8th inning. Just a tremendous story. So yeah, check it out on MLB.com. It was an honor to write, really.
Well, it's a great piece. I really enjoyed reading it and was not familiar with the story. So thank you for doing that. And thank you for joining us, man. I really appreciate it.
You bet. Absolutely. Thanks a lot.
Manny Randhawa, MLB.com. A lot of great work over there. Not just on the Rockies. He also does a lot of stats and research stuff for MLB.com, but Colorado based. You get a lot of Rockies stuff as well. And again, it's a terrific feature on Dave Dravecki. It's a great book, The Blake Street Bombers, on that era of the Colorado Rockies. So make sure you check all that stuff out. Manny on MLB on Twitter. We're going to take a break. In the second hour, we'll... not Schadenfreude necessarily, but the Red Sox are not doing too well, and they might be, it's getting late for them in the wild card race. We'll talk to Brandon Wiley of The Score about that. We'll also talk about Rafael Devers as a contract comp for Vlad. Jeff Passan had some very interesting comments on the Blair and Barker show with Ben Ennis filling in for Jeff Blair last week. We'll visit some of those as well as it pertains to what Vlad's next contract could look like. We'll also talk to Sam Blum of The Athletic, get the Angels side of the series. All that's next as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Big guests and bigger opinions on everything happening in Leafsland. Real Kipper and Bourne. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy, little Hootie and the Blowfish for our next guest. But before we get to that guest, a special happy birthday to Ben Nicholson-Smith. Everyone should go bug him on Twitter and give him a happy birthday. We are joined now by Brandon Wiley of The Score. Brandon, I know you're a bit of a Hootie and the Blowfish guy. I don't think Zoom guests can hear the music, but I played Jim with it. How are we doing?
Hootie was actually one of my first CDs I've ever bought. Way back in the day when you could buy like 12 CDs for one set.
Columbia House. I know it well. Might have named a music show after it.
So I got a Hootie and the Blowfish, Jewel, and I think an Alanis Morissette album. Those were three of my first ever CDs.
I was allowed to get one from my dad's 12 set. I got Frog Stomp, the debut album from Silverchair. I bring up music with intention because in addition to Hootie and the Blowfish, you're a man of taste. You're an Alexis on Fire fan. What did you think of Wade McNeil putting his first pitch in the dirt on Saturday?
I try to pat or hold judgment on that because I've never done it, and I guarantee you it's way more terrifying than it looks. I'll give him a pass because his music's good. So, he'll get a pass from me for that one.
All right. He did also do a fake press conference after blaming a bunch of other factors, which I appreciated. All right. Let's use that as a pivot. What are the Red Sox blaming right now, man? It's been I know the Astros are good, but it's four in a row, and it's eight of the last 14 here after a deadline where it looked like they were pushing in at least a little bit to make it. What do you make of where the Red Sox were at coming out of this weekend?
I think for the Red Sox, I think the trade deadline hit about 2 weeks too early for them. I think if they would have had like a mid-August trade deadline, it would have been perfect because you could tell, like, obviously a great first half of the season, but coming right out of the All-Star break, you could see the cracks were really starting to show. The pitching staff that had been so good all year is really starting to run on fumes. They had such good performances from Cutter Crawford and Tanner Houck and a lot of their young guys to start the first half. And now they're hitting those limits where they've never really reached before as big leaguers. And they're really starting to show that wear and tear, I think. Cutter Crawford especially, he gives up so many home runs now. I think he's given up 13 home runs since the All-Star break. Tanner Houck has really struggled. The offense has been actually really good since the All-Star break, but they really just can't keep up with the pitching staff. And right now they're hitting a really tough part of their schedule. You really wanted to catch the Astros, I think, in the first half when they were struggling. Yeah. Now they're playing really well. Yordan Alvarez, when he plays at Fenway Park, he's terrifying. Alex Cora said he's pretty much David Ortiz reincarnated, which, as we all know, is a pretty terrifying proposition to pitch to. I think the Red Sox they're playing with kind of found money this year after all the injuries. A lot of the really young players stepped up. And like I said, the pitching staff has hit a wall. And it really makes you appreciate how much of a grind getting through a full season and through a long playoffs is with your pitching. As the Jays know right now, it's like when you don't have five or six starters throughout the year, which is so rare, it's so hard to have so much depth to get through a whole season, which makes – any team that wins the World Series, you really appreciate how much of a grind that is.
Yeah. I mean, since the All-Star break, their starter's ERA is almost 6. Their reliever's ERA is almost 7. You can't hit your way out of all of that. Yeah. And now James Paxton got hurt as well, left that game. That didn't look like a small injury. No. So I don't know. What is the, like, are we back into Quinn Priester territory? Is Brad Keller slide into the right? What do they do here in the interim?
Well, it's kind of scary that Rich Hill might be like the savior if they can get him signed. I know that he lives in Massachusetts and he had a little showcase and he pitched well. I don't know if Rich Hill wants to win a World Series this year. Joining the Red Sox might not be the option, but he can hopefully give you innings. It really sucks for Paxton. I thought that was a really nice under the radar move. They were familiar with him and he could at least give them like some sort of quality innings. But yeah, like you said, it sounds like a calf injury. I think that's what it was diagnosed. I was hoping it wasn't Achilles when you watched it yesterday because it looked pretty scary. Anytime a pitcher kind of bends over and grabs your leg like that. Quinn Priester might be an option. I don't know if they'd want to rush him. He kind of seemed like more of a project. Maybe Josh Winkowski slides into the rotation. Cooper Criswell just went on the COVID IL. He might be an option. But yeah, it's kind of ugly right now, and they have Houston again coming up. They have Texas. I know Texas isn't doing well this year, but they got some bombers, and you don't really want to face Texas in that lineup at Fenway Park. They have that weird 5-game homestand with the Jays coming up. The Jays always play well at Fenway, and they have another trip to Houston. I don't know if I mentioned that. So
yeah,
the schedule is really, really tough for them right now. And the way their pitching staff is going, you can kind of see that they're teetering on the wheels completely falling off here.
Yeah, Diamondbacks in there somewhere as well, who are, you know, I think the best offense in the National League in terms of runs per game. So no let up there until you get to the 5-gamer against the Jays. And who knows Well, you'll be seeing that now. Look, they still have 32% playoff odds today based on, you know, Fangraph's projection model. And hey, at least Danny Jansen looks pretty good, right? Yes. He's off to a nice start.
Yes. Yeah, good for Danny Jansen. I think landing at Fenway was probably a nice boost for his free agent market, because I know his numbers were kind of down the last couple months in Toronto, but he gets a bit of a fresh start. Gets to work with Jason Varitek, which is probably really cool for him. And yeah, he's hitting at a hitter friendly park for the next 2 months, and hopefully he can go into free agency and really cash in. I know a lot of Jays fans are big Danny Jansen supporters, and he'll probably still be the top catcher on the free agent market, because it's very thin. So he should do pretty well.
Yeah, it's like him, Carson Kelly, James McCann. Yeah. It's not a deep list, and lots of teams always need catching. Although weirdly, catchers don't make a lot of money because of the attrition rate and stuff like that. It's an odd one. Staying with the Sox. So let's say, obviously, again, 32% playoff odds. Maybe you don't like it that much because of the pitching injuries and things like that. So let's call it 25%. So let's play out the scenario where they don't make the playoffs. When Craig Breslow took over, we were not immediately sure what his plan would be in terms of timeline and things like that. Inherited a fairly expensive team, but a decent farm system. I know three of their top prospects just got promoted to AAA. So, you know, there's a proximity for those prospects. Are the Red Sox back in push for it mode as soon as this offseason?
I think so from the pitching staff. I felt like this year was, like you said, was an opportunity for Craig Breslow to really get his feet wet, to kind of see what he has in the organization, to see what they have at the lower levels. And they didn't go over the luxury tax. I know the luxury tax isn't as scary as it was before the penalties, but I think that was big. They cleared out some salary with Chris Sale. Kenley Jansen, Chris Martin are free agents at the end of the year. So is Nick Pivetta and Tyler O'Neill. So they have a lot of money coming off the books, and they have what every team loves is young players who play every day who don't make any money.
Yeah.
So that makes building a team a lot easier. So you have a core of Jaron Duran. Willie Abreu is a nice piece. Connor Wong has really taken the next step this year. Tristan Casas. So you have the pieces and the foundation in place. I think they really need to go, and you spend in the free agent market for starting pitching. You're going to really need to address that bullpen as well, which every team needs to address their bullpen in the offseason. But you could also start to clear out some of that glut of prospects now that Breslow is familiar with who he thinks could help in the major league level and who he thinks he could probably deal out. Maybe you swing a trade for one or two starters. Lucas Giolito will be back next year. I don't know how you can project him. He's probably a middle of the rotation starter right now. Garrett Whitlock might be a reliever at this point. He just had Tommy John surgery, and the conversion to the rotation didn't really work well. So I don't necessarily think they're still all in. This year was probably their final year of fully retooling. But I can imagine them being aggressive this winter and really start to build the next Red Sox core and next really Red Sox contender here.
So two pretty big free agents with a interesting free agent market there. I mean, outside of Danny Jansen and the weirdness of the catcher market, Tyler O'Neill, other than Anthony Santander, like, might be the best on per plate appearance bat available in free agency. Yeah. But he's never healthy. He's on the IL again now with a calf infection. What do you make of how that's going to look? Like, there have been very few outfielders who have been able to hit at the level that he's hit the last couple of years, but you're looking at, you know, 70 games, 80 games, maybe 90 games there. What do you make of how things could look for Tyler O'Neill?
Yeah, I mean, he's been a really fun player. One of the perfect fits for Fenway Park. Just destroys the monster. He's not a great outfielder, but he's pretty good. Good runner, like good athleticism. And like you said, the only thing that really holds him back are the strikeouts, but you sacrifice some strikeouts with power. But the injuries, the durability, so... And once again, like you said, he's on the IL again. I could see his market being like a 3 to 4 year deal, maybe in the $15 to $20 million a year range. Okay. Kind of like the Lourdes Gurriel deal, maybe a little higher. I don't think he's going to be like a 480 type guy. But like you said, with him and Santander and Teoscar are really the only really big impact bats, I think that he should probably do well. I don't know if the Red Sox will offer him a qualifying offer. They might be scared that he might take that, especially with how crowded the row field is. But you can tell when his how a right-handed bat is on the lineup, they do miss him, and he will be a desirable piece. So I'm curious to see if they do attach that qualifying offer to him.
Yeah, 20 million or so, and if you get 120 games out of him, you probably get 25, 30 bombs. Yeah. It's a tough account. And then there's Nick Pivetta, who's like, I mean, he's 31 at this point, so maybe this is just who he is, but like years of the stuff and the underlying metrics are better than the ERA. Like again, this year, like in terms of swing and miss, he's like top five to top 10 in starting pitchers every year. His expected ERA is about a run lower than his actual ERA, big strikeout rate, low walk rate. What do you make of how teams may evaluate that kind of profile where, again, like it could be a blip, but it's like three of the last four seasons that's been the case for him where the actual results don't match up with everything else?
Yeah, you could see why the Red Sox wanted him in the first place. It is frustrating. Like you said, he'll go and he'll strike out eight batters in a row. And he's like, where is this consistency every time? I actually thought the Red Sox would have been wise to maybe talk about an extension with him coming into this season because he has been a very valuable piece. And what I like about him, too, is that he'll take the ball in any situation. You saw last year when it wasn't working as a starter, he went in as a reliever, and he was probably one of their best relievers last year. He kind of transitioned back into the rotation this year when he found something. But I do think a guy like Nick Pivetta is that he'll give you innings. And sometimes you do take the bad outings if he'll give you two good outings. And that's really valuable. Like we said, to go back to how hard it is to get through a season and get enough innings from your rotation. So I see Nick Pivetta will probably get a multi-year deal. I don't think he will be a qualifying offer guy, but you could also make another argument that spending $20 million on a guy who will give you probably 150 innings, there's a lot of value in that. And especially if he can bounce, he probably won't want to bounce from the rotation into the bullpen, but he's a guy that has done it and probably will do it. And he seems like he has a good enough attitude that he will do whatever the team wants him to do.
Okay. So we're talking a lot of Red Sox. You mentioned the difficulty of coming to terms on an extension with a Nick Pivetta type. The Red Sox managed to do that with Rafael Devers not all that long ago. And I bring that up to transition back to a Jays topic where Rafael Devers is maybe the most interesting comp for Vladimir Guerrero Jr. Devers, for anyone who doesn't remember, they only came up with a one-year deal initially for his final arb year, then revisited and did the 10-year, I guess 10-year, $313.5 million. There are some deferrals and other kind of things in there. But Devers signed that extension at the end of his age 25 season, playing a below average third base with the asterisk that, hey, he's probably a first baseman by the end of this year, end of this deal rather. And then this deal kicks in this year. How similar do you find the situations situation-wise and statistically if we're looking for comps for Vladimir Guerrero Jr. extension talks heading into his final arb year?
I think Devers is probably the perfect comp for him. Other than the position, pretty much everything else is similar. The bat is so similar. The age is similar. Even where the teams are at, I find is similar. With the Red Sox, obviously everyone knows how they handled the Mookie Betts situation. They weren't willing to let Devers go, and they weren't willing to let that final year play out, which I think was wise to get that deal under contract because the Red Sox were not competitive going into that year. They knew they weren't going to be competitive, but they knew that Devers was young enough that if they got him signed long-term, he could kind of buy into being part of this next wave, being part of that anchor and that star that will still be there and still be in his prime when the team is competitive again. And I know that the Jays want to be competitive in 2025. I don't know how realistic that is, but if you get Vladimir Guerrero locked up through his age 35 season, you're still getting the next 5, 6, 7 years of his prime right now. So when the swing comes where they are really competitive again, you're getting a 27, 28, 29-year-old Vladimir Guerrero Jr., who's going to most likely be very, very productive. And you can't – you look at baseball now, and I know baseball isn't as star-driven as the NBA is, but it's hard to find stars. And once you have a star that can sit in your middle of your order, you really need to do everything you can to lock that up. I mean, look where the Jays would be without Vlad this year. I know things aren't great, but at least for the final 2 months of the season, why are people watching the Jays? Well, they're watching because they want to see Vladimir Guerrero Jr. Why are they buying tickets? Well, they want to go see this star player. So I think it's so important for them to lock Vlad up. And I know that Vlad's a first baseman. I know Devers is a third baseman. Devers is, he's an adequate third baseman. He's never going to win a Gold Glove. He probably, like you said, will move over to first base eventually. But I don't think you can treat Vlad as just like, oh, he's a first baseman. First baseman don't get paid. There's so many more layers to that equation that, like I said, he's so marketable. He's a homegrown star. He's entering an age in when you don't really get free agents. So all those things kind of, I think, push the ceiling a little higher as to just he's just a first baseman. You can't pay a first baseman.
Yeah, and it's tough, too, because, like, that is partially true. The first baseman DH thing, like, a lot of those contracts don't end up all that well. But if you look at the guys who have had success at that position, almost all of them peaked late. Edwin peaked late. David Ortiz peaked late. Like, there's a good case. And then, like, it's interesting. You start looking at the comps for guys who hit free agency this early and were this good offensively, and it's like outlier guys who reach the majors at like 18 or 19 or are bad comps for other reasons. Like Giancarlo and Bryce Harper are on there. And it's like, okay, well, those guys also have a lot of injury complications with how that's played out and things like that. Corey Seager is like offense through age 25 season, but I think defensively that makes it too tough of a comp. So Jeff Passan was on Blair and Barker last week with Ben Ennis filling in for Jeff Blair, and he had been on before, and I'm paraphrasing here, but he basically said like he didn't think Vlad would get $300 million necessarily. And then he said when he was on last week, he had a couple executives text him after that immediately and be like, you're a moron. 300's the floor, not the ceiling. So when you look at Devers 10 years, 313, you hear Jeff Passan say 300 might be the floor, not the ceiling. Where is your comfort level if you're the Blue Jays? Like how, I guess the thing with any negotiation is like the point that you'll agree on is like the first dollar where you're uncomfortable with it. But like, I don't know, where do you think the discomfort sets in? Like if it's 10-300, is that a comfortable number for you if you're the Blue Jays, do you think?
Yeah, I think so. I think that would be a great deal. Even you look at the Bryce Harper contract now, he signed for 13 years, $330 million. And at the time, that seemed like a lot of money. But now that seems like one of the most valuable contracts in the majors. And he's also a guy who had to move to first base. I know he signed as an outfielder at the time, but you're getting that production for that money for a first base from Bryce Harper. You are taking that deal every day of the week now. And like you said with Vlad, like he's insanely durable. And I think that's something that gets overlooked with him a lot is that he posts every single day. I don't know if he's been on the IL, but if he has, it was not for a lengthy stay so far in his career. So knock on wood, that's another thing that you're paying for. As far as the contract, I think every player wants to beat the last player who signed. So I would expect Vlad's camp to want a little bit more than Devers signed. He's going to set the record for first baseman, regardless, no matter what deal he gets. The 10-300 million, I think, is a good range. Getting a little higher, you're going to want more years maybe to drive that AAV down. But I think 10-300 is definitely a fair range. And if they don't get him signed, you look at the teams that need a bat right now, like there's not a lot of bottom feeders left that are tanking now. So you look at the Giants, you look at the Yankees, the Cubs. There's a lot of teams that are traditional big spenders who need a first baseman or need a power right-handed bat who are not going to be into the Soto sweepstakes. So maybe they take a year off and maybe they get into the Vlad sweepstakes. So I think if you're the Blue Jays, letting Guerrero even consider testing free agent will be dangerous because the price will probably, they're going to have to pay a premium to keep him from going to free agency. But once you get to free agency, it only takes one team. Look at what Xander Bogaerts signed for in San Diego. It only takes one aggressive owner, to sign that deal. And you get Vlad Guerrero, you get that name, you get that lineage. Maybe Artie Moreno and the Angels want to reunite there. So you never know. And like I said, you don't want to let him even sniff free agency if you really want to keep him long term.
Yeah, you mentioned the posting there and the durability. And yeah, it's first base / DH, so maybe it's a little different. But since he became a full-time regular in the major leagues, only Marcus Semien and Freddie Freeman have more plate appearances. So, another pretty durable first base DH type. Yeah. And then Mr. I post every day, Marcus Semien, I think he could be on crutches and he'd still be like, I'm getting my four plate appearances in. Brandon, thanks so much for getting this plate appearance in, man. Really appreciate it.
Awesome. See you next week at the
Are you at Blinken Alexis on Thursday?
That's Thursday. If I do, I'll text you.
Okay, let me know. All right, thanks, man. Brendan Wiley of The Score. Yeah, make sure you're following all his great work, all their great work overall. Good piece from Travis Sochik at The Score over the weekend as well. And then obviously a great hub for keeping up with news around the league. Speaking of around the league, the Blue Jays will play a Los Angeles Angels team that it may sneak up on you that they've been pretty good lately. They have a winning record over the last like 50 games. They are also, you know, if we narrow that into the last little while, 14-11 over their last 25, they're not playing as bad a baseball as you might expect for a team that's two games below the Blue Jays in the standings. Let's take a break. Let's talk to Sam Blum of The Athletic, figure out what's going on with this Angels team playing a little better, despite not having Shohei, despite Mike Trout being on the IL once again. Sneaky fun team, sneaky fun series this week and then next weekend. We'll see. We'll talk to Sam Blum next as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Unrivaled insight, analysis, and opinions on all things Blue Jays. Blair and Barker. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy, calling all Angels there, a little train. Let's get to know this Angels team a little better that the Jays will play three with starting tonight at 9:38 down in Anaheim, and then three more next weekend. Let's talk to Sam Blum of The Athletic, one of my favorite guys to read. Sam, good morning. How are we doing?
I'm doing good. I love hearing the calling all Angels song. I'd only hear it about 90 times a year, so it's...
What's one more? Yeah, exactly. Right? Got to ask you, man. I'm getting ahead of myself here. The Jays are in LA for this series, but the Angels are going to turn around and be right back here. Are you going to get to come to Rogers Center, sight of one of your favorite artists, Lady Raven, in the movie Trap?
Oh yeah. No, actually, I'm not going to. It's not as big of a series as it was last year.
Yeah.
I'm sure you remember. My first time in the Rogers Center was last summer. And for that, big series right before kind of the trade deadline. But no, this year, both teams are kind of out of it. So not going to be making the trip this year, but hopefully in 2025.
Hopefully. Yeah. Hopefully both of these teams are a little more interesting, a little more juice to the series next year. This is an Angels team that has been kind of interesting of late. They did get walked off in the 10th twice by the Nationals. This weekend, though, that's a bit of a rough one. But generally speaking, this is an Angels team that's played okay baseball the last 2 months or so. What's gone into that? What do you see in them, being not world beaters, but more competent than maybe you would have expected for a late season Angels team?
Yeah, I think that the biggest thing, if you kind of look at the split from the end of May, the first 2 months of the year and really, the last two and a half months is just a lot of their younger players are actually performing. That was kind of, I think, the purpose of this season to some extent. They were projecting a competitive playoff team before the year started and really, throughout the first few months of the season. But it was just always clear to everyone that was never going to be the case. So, to me, that's why they perform better. Logan Ohapi, Zach Neto, even Nolan Shanahwell, these guys have actually been quite good. Jose Soriano in the rotation, Ben Joyce has come up, have been really good out of the bullpen. So that's why they're performing better. The big question for me is, what does that all kind of mean? Where is the kind of the end game of that? Do the Angels, build around this core, or are they going to do what they kind of always do, which is just kind of fumble it? And by that, I mean just, not put the requisite pieces around, having a good young core of players to actually compete and do well, which they can do as soon as next year if they just, commit the resources to it. I'm not confident in that. I've covered this team now four seasons, and, there's nothing about the way that they operate that makes me feel like they're going to capitalize. But to answer your question, that's why things are going better. Now it's a question of, can you be a better than 500 team? Can you be a team that's truly, competitive and right now they're showing some signs of it, but there's a lot of work to be done.
So when you look at the trade deadline they have, and I know it's 2 weeks ago now, so I apologize for going back there, but I was a little surprised that some of these guys are still on this team. And I know Luis Renjifo is now on the IL, and maybe the wrist stuff that he's dealt with has had a part of that, but were you surprised that they weren't a little bit more aggressive selling some of their veteran pieces off with an eye toward that longer term build?
Yeah, I definitely think I was surprised by that. And I didn't think of it. This is what I talk about, kind of fumbling things to some extent. I think that they maybe had too high of a price tag on some of these players. And, you know, and it's possible. I mean, Luis Reynifo was coming off of an IL stint. He came back for like a week and was not his himself. And so that could have seriously impacted his value. You look at a guy like Taylor Ward, not been good for 2 months. I mean, he's picked it up the last week and a half or so, but before the deadline, I mean, he was struggling mightily for 2 months. You know, Tyler Anderson, for as good as he is this year, I don't think a lot of teams are going to, you know, sit there and say this guy's going to be our number one, number two, or even number three in a playoff rotation. So you're talking about value. You might not be getting the value that you kind of think you should be getting or you hope to get out of those players. But at the end of the day, to me, the Angels needed to stockpile as much as they could in their farm system this trade deadline, and they didn't do it. Even like keeping Kevin Pillar, you know, Matt Moore, they could have eaten some of his salary. You know, he's having a tough year, but, you know, probably couldn't gotten something for him. I mean, I just felt like they needed to do whatever they could to build up what was the worst farm system in baseball, probably 28th, 29th now with the guys that they got, and they just didn't do enough of that. And so, you know, like I said, they've got some good young players, but, you know, you want a pipeline of young players. You want to be able to keep bringing guys up, keep seeing that. That's why teams like the Orioles, you know, even the Reds, the Rays, I mean, the Dodgers, I mean, this is what they do, and this is how they're successful year after year. And, you know, I think for the Angels, that's still a long ways off, despite, you know, having some players that might be all-stars for you as soon as next season. So I think that's where they made some mistakes. But, you know, ultimately, they might feel that they're closer to contention now, keeping a Luis Reynifo or Taylor Ward for next year. I mean, their plan is always, they never rebuild. I mean, that's always their problem. They'll never say, hey, we're not going to be good this year. They didn't even say it this year when I think everyone knew they wouldn't be good. So that's their problem. And you know, I think that's why they've gone 15 years without a playoff win.
Yeah, it's a tough one. And I mean, in terms of restocking the system here in Toronto, we saw the Jays be the most aggressive seller at the deadline. They trade 8 guys away, get 13 prospects back, and you're still the worst system in the American League East. Like, it takes a lot of work. So you got to do that when you can. With respect to that, I know mostly this is a management and ownership thing and not wanting to admit that you're in a rebuild and things like that. That idea that they could turn it around and be competitive again next year with some of these young guys and you keep Reynifo and Anderson, how much of everything right now just kind of has a cloud on it because of the future of Mike Trout and his ability to get healthy and stay healthy? Like we saw 30 games of Trout earlier this year. He looked like Mike Trout, but it's hard to imagine we're going to see 130 games of Mike Trout anytime soon. How much does that cloud things?
You know, it's interesting. Like, the day that they announced that he was getting his second surgery, Perry Minazzi and the Angels GM also said, I expect him to come back next year and be an MVP and hit 70 homers. And I just don't think that, like, and I get where he's coming from and I get the motivation behind, you know, wanting to pump a guy up and make him feel like he's got that still. But I think that is kind of the Angels' problem in a nutshell, is the expectation that you know, you're going to get that out of him. At this point, I think with Mike Trout, the goal should be keeping him relatively healthy and doing that by any means possible, whether that's moving him to a corner outfield, DHing him, giving him more days off, just whatever you can do to keep him healthy. Because at this point, I think that you have to bake into the fact that he's not that guy that he was during his prime years when he was winning MVPs and he was, you know, just an on-base machine. It's just, even when he's been healthy, he's not been that player. He's not really been that close to that player to some extent. You know, just a lot of those underlying numbers, a lot of the swing and miss. So to me, yeah, I mean, that's a big thing with the Angels. They got 6 more years of Mike Trout at, you know, at more than $35 million a year, and, you know, 7 more years of Anthony Rendon at more than, you know, $38 million a year. So these are, you've got just a lot of money baked into two players that for the most part are just either not playing for you or when they do play, not really playing that well for you. So the Angels are basically a small market team at this point because they don't really spend elsewhere. You know, I think people are not really quite realizing that to some extent. This is a small market baseball team. It shouldn't be, but that's what this is. And you got to bake into the fact that Mike Trout is just not Mike Trout right now. And I think there's a huge question mark as to whether or not he becomes that player again. And it's not, no disrespect to him. It's just where he's at with his injuries and where he's at when he's healthy. It's just not, it's not what people are used to.
No, and it sucks for the Angels. It sucks for baseball, man. Like a guy who could be a 10-win guy at his peak, yeah. You know, kind of not being able to stay healthy for like 4 or 5 years here. It sucks, and I don't envy the Angels, but like you've kind of laid out, it's not as if they were optimizing Mike Trout beforehand. Now, one of the ways they can, you know, be competitive maybe sooner, and maybe this is part of why the farm system hasn't been this great, or maybe this is part of the draft strategy and things like that. What do you make of how aggressive the Angels are, always are with pushing their prospects through the minors, where Nolan Chanuel debuts almost right away. You had a great piece with Christian Moore, who's already, you sat down with him, did a Q&A at The Athletic. He's already been pushed to AA. Klassen, who they picked up, is getting pushed to AA pretty quickly. What do you make of that element of it? Is it part of that small market mentality of get cheaper talent up quicker? Is it more of a player development strategy? Why does it seem they're the most aggressive?
I think it's out of necessity to some extent. This is, you know, last year you call up Nolan Chanuel because they didn't really have a first baseman at that point. I mean, then I just don't like it. I feel like it's comes from a place of desperation at times. I'm not saying every situation is like that. I mean, you look at when Zach Neto was called up. This was in Boston, April last year. They had like three or four errors in a game, and then the next day Zach Neto's making his debut because their infield defense and just not good enough, and you know they felt like he was a better option, and so I think that you take big risks in it. Now, that being said, there has been a lot of success thus far in this strategy. I would say that Neto has looked like a legitimately good big league baseball player, potential all-star. I think especially this last week, he's been, you know, kind of absurd. So I think that's really exciting. Nolan Chanuel has, you know, maybe not had that level of success yet, but he's been holding his own. He's got a OPS over, I think, 710, 720, something like that. I mean, this is a, you know, he's right now, I would say, just about an average big league player that when you're 22 years old, you expect that to, to improve. And so he was able to weather some really tough, slumps thus far, which I think is pretty important for a young player, you know, not to spiral. And he didn't spiral. That being said, I think that the strategy will, at some point backfire, because it's not really a strategy. It's not really a player development strategy. If anything, I think it speaks to maybe a lack of confidence to some extent in your player development or whatever that might be, because, you know, it's at some point one of these players will get seriously impacted. But I think you look at Joe Adell, was called up super early in 2020, and it has impacted him. He's never developed into like a really good baseball player that people expected him to be. And he's shown some improvements this year, but it's still, you know, far off from what the expectations were. And so to me, that's the issue here is you're pushing the envelope in a way that just doesn't really make a lot of sense. Now, it's on an individual, you know, case by case basis, but I wouldn't be surprised if Christian Moore's up here by the time Blue Jays leave town it'd probably be when the Braves get here, you know, on Friday or Saturday or something like that. But at the end of the day, I don't love the strategy, but it hasn't really backfired on them yet. Just think it will at some point, because it's not really a viable way to operate in a major league environment.
Yeah, it's tough. And then, I mean, they didn't sign their third rounder, Ryan Prager. There's a lot going on there. There was Christian Moore already being at that level. It's such a great out of context quote from your Q&A with him. Right now, I'm a trash panda. Of the Houston Astros AAA team, the Space Cowboys, I don't know you could get a better soundbite than right now. I'm a trash panda.
That's a fair point.
Did want to dig in a little bit more on Joe Adell. So you mentioned he got called up early and it hasn't quite materialized. And he's a guy that, like, I mean, if you're a fantasy player, you see some of the output. If you tune into an Angels game, like, he's so clearly toolsed up, right? The new bat speed metrics come out and he's right near the top. Where is that gap still right now for him between having all these tools, having the stack cast outputs, having the potential, but it not leading to consistent production at the major league level?
I think it's instincts. I think it's 100% instincts. And you see it like in the base running. I mean, he's probably one of the fastest guys in the major leagues, but he'll get thrown out a lot. He'll make some base running blunders. He's definitely improved on it to some extent, but he's on base less than he was early on in the year. I mean, that's just the simple fact. He was getting on base a lot more. And then, you know, he had about a 2-month stretch where he was almost an automatic out. He's improved things the last couple of weeks after eliminating a leg kick. It's just with Joe, it's like, I mean, I think he's hitting around 200. I mean, you know, this has always been like this question with him is like, how much of a leash do you kind of give him to prove himself? And this is really his first full year in the big leagues. And, you know, I don't know where they're going to stand after the year. If he's improved, you know, significantly defensively this year, but his bat isn't really there. Is this somebody you're going into spring training with as a starter next season? I think is a big question. I think it maybe is indicative of their, you know, desire to compete next year. Because, you know, I think what you might see is improvement, but is it enough to be an everyday player on a competitive team? It depends on a couple factors. One, what do you surround him with? And then two, like, you know, do you feel like you've, that there's a pathway to, in season improvement next year. And Do you feel like he's on that trajectory? And right now, I think that's it's 50-50. I mean, there are certain signs that make you feel like, okay, he's figuring certain things out. And then there's enough to be like, it's just not happening, right? Like, he's had his chances and it's just not happened. So, you know, I think they could go either way on this, but, you know, it's he's just such a tempting player to keep around because, like you said, those tools are so good. And then, you know, even beyond that, I mean, I think the biggest nightmare for any team would be what happens if you trade him or you release him or whatever, and then he figures it out somewhere else. Because I think that's certainly possible with a young 25-year-old player who's shown nothing but potential, you know, over the years. So, and then some improvement in the last year. So he's got no options. He's got no minor league options. It's just like a really tough position for them to be in. You know, similar with Moniak, who's you know, again, a lot of potential. Number one overall pick, not performed that well, but you know, the last 2.5 months he's actually been a really decent big league ball player. But I just don't know where that leaves you after this year and kind of how you evaluate these guys and the desire to be a competitive team long term.
It's tough. I tell you, if Joe Adell became available as a buy low, there are teams that would jump. I would, if I were another team and I looked at what the Angels had done historically with player development, you know, you're probably looking like Angels, White Sox, Rockies. Those are the teams you want to be like, well, I could get more out of that guy than they did, maybe. Someone who is having success, though, we talked about some of the position players there. Ben Joyce has also come up from the minors. When we factor in the effective extension down the mound, only Mason Miller, who we just saw, has a higher average velocity, you know, 99.7 and then about 101 once we factor in the impact of that extension. And he kind of just throws the gas. He's such a fascinating guy to me statistically because he throws 100 every single time and doesn't strike anyone out, but is having these results. I know he had big strikeout numbers in the minors. It's been more the ground ball stuff at the major league level here. How big a find is he for that Angels bullpen long term?
I mean, the thing is, like you mentioned, like the average velocity being lower than Mason Miller, he could throw harder than Mason Miller. Mm-hmm. He could, if he wanted to, and that's what he was doing when he first got called up this year, was the first two outings, he was just throwing heat, and it's, you know, people will hit heat if it's just flat and it's just right at you. But what he did was he added a sinker after like the first two or three outings, and like, that's why his average velocity is like slightly below 100. I think it's because he's throwing like a 97, 98 mile an hour sinker, like almost every pitch. And that's why he's getting a lot of ground balls. I mean, it's working. I mean, yesterday he was not good. His last couple outings have been maybe not great, but he went on about a month and a half stretch where he didn't allow a single run, you know, after adding that sinker. So I imagine that the Angels are looking at this guy as a long-term closer for them. He's going to be doing this, you know, for years and years. You know, that's where the success is coming from, just adding that sinker. And he's even, you know, kind of flirted with the changeup a little bit recently too. So he's certainly a really, really interesting player. I think there was a lot of doubt coming out of the draft because he just, you know, even that fastball coming out of the draft, he was just not pitching ever for Tennessee. He was like throwing once every 4 or 5 days, and it's like they were just putting kid gloves on him. And now the Angels, you know, kind of with their MO said, we're going to take those kid gloves off immediately. And, you know, thus far it's worked. I mean, I think you've got to be careful with a guy like him and make sure doesn't, you know, re-up his injury history. But the way he's pitching right now, I think that there's a lot of excitement about his future as a closer for years to come.
Certainly. And it's, he's a fun watch for sure. Mason Miller was a fun watch this week. Well, fun-ish. Yeah. You know, it's fun to watch, but then you know you've only got 8 innings to, like, strikes it. He makes Vlad, the hottest hitter in baseball right now, look silly in one of those. Okay, before I let you go, I want to go outside the Angels here. You spent a bunch of time with the White Sox during that losing streak, and then Pedro Grifol gets let go. What did you, I mean, how cool was that assignment? Like, weird, but cool assignment. And what did you pick up from doing it and following the White Sox through some of that historic losing stretch there?
Really fun assignment. I like, you know, going to where the interesting stories are. And honestly, like, being around the White Sox, you know, you don't know what to expect. I think my presence in the clubhouse was not always, like, super. It was a little awkward at times because, you know, I think that to some extent, like, they didn't necessarily, especially Pedro Grifol, and obviously he's been fired. You know, I don't think he truly understood how much of a national story. I mean, you know, when you're bad, you're irrelevant. I think that the Angels and the Blue Jays this year, to some extent, understand that. But when you're that bad, when you're like historically horrible, then it becomes a national story. I don't think that he really picked up on that. I mean, if you lost 20 games in a row, people are going to ask questions about it. And that's why I was there. And, you know, you could tell why they're losing games. I mean, just the roster isn't not there for one, but also it was just a kind of a sad environment to some extent. It didn't feel like they you know, necessarily loved playing for Pedro. And I, you know, you think you saw the last couple of games against the Cubs, they, you know, they put up a little more of a fight. So maybe a change is not going to make them a winning team, but, you know, we'll see if they can avoid being the worst team of all time. You know, they still have enough games to avoid that fate, but it'll be really fascinating. And honestly, like, the White Sox this year are one of the most interesting stories in baseball. And for how a storied franchise can become, you know, 120, 125 lost teams is absolutely fascinating. I mean, you understand the 62 expansion Mets, but for a team that's just, you know, won a World Series less than 20 years ago, I mean, it's just crazy to think about. And, you know, honestly won their division by 13 games 3 years ago. So it's crazy. And we'll see what happens the last month and a half. I will certainly be tuning in to see how that plays out.
No pressure, Grady Sizemore, in your first gig here. Sam, thanks so much for taking the time out. And man, we don't have time to talk about it today, and it would be weird to do on Toronto Sports Radio anyway, but unbelievable reporting on the Tyler Skaggs situation and getting that interview with Eric Kay and contextualizing that. One of the best and most empathetic things that I can remember reading around baseball. So keep up the great work, man.
That means a lot to me. I appreciate that very much. Thanks for having me.
Sam Blum of The Athletic. Make sure you go check out all that great work. He's SamBlum3 on Twitter as well. Let's get you set for this series. It is a 9:38 start every night this week. So, you know, stay up, get ready. Bowden Francis against Davis Daniel. Tonight, Kevin Gausman against Carson Fulmer. Jose Berríos against Tyler Anderson to round it out. The Jays will then be off Thursday and then play a three-set against the Cubs, including an afternoon game Friday, because it's at Wrigley. Of course, it's an afternoon game. Davis Daniel, who you see tonight, 27-year-old righty, kind of a non-prospect, had a cup of coffee last year as a long man, wasn't pitching particularly well at AAA before he got called up, has a 6.04 ERA here in the early going, doesn't walk anyone. Cool. The stuff is not great when you look at the stuff plus metrics or just watch him pitch or whatever. Well below average. But one thing he does do very, very well is he locates. He doesn't walk a lot of guys. He puts the pitches where he wants to pitch them. If you look at some of those pitch modeling stats, the location plus or whatever, he grades out pretty well by that. So he can pitch a little bit. He just doesn't have great stuff. You'll see a fastball that's about 92 miles an hour, slider curveball to righties, changeup slider curveball to lefties. The curveball is the only one of those that's really a swing and miss pitch, but he doesn't throw it all that often, like less than 10% of the time. On the other side, it's Bowden Francis. That ERA after that tough start to the year, down to 5.44 now, which I know isn't that great, but you look at his 13 appearances since getting called back up, we're looking at a 3.41 ERA. So he's turned into, you know, a reasonable swing man the last little bit. His last start against the Orioles was the best of his career, even though they'd just seen him the week prior. So some stuff to build on there. You know, still not missing enough bats, and it's too fly ball a profile. You know, not getting enough swing and miss, things like that. There's still a lot of work to do, but it has trended in the right direction the last little bit. It's fastball, curveball, slider to righties. The splitter is going to feature heavily against lefties. None of those pitches have great results. It's a bit weird. Like, the fastball is the best run value, so situationally, but he's also given up 6 homers on it. The slider is his best swing and miss pitch, but he can't throw at the lefties. The splitter has the best ground ball rate, but it gets hit for a high average. And then the curveball is just kind of bad across the board. We'll see how the Angels handle it. Only 2 lefties usually in their lineup, including Nolan Chanuel near the top of that thing. So we'll see. It might not be a big splitter night for Bowden Francis, or maybe it's a night he tries to use it a little bit more to righties for a change. Couple small updates for you before we wrap the show. It is expected that Will Wagner will join the team in LA for this series. Luis De Los Santos was optioned down without a corresponding move. Will Wagner didn't play on Sunday. He was put on the mystery list roster-wise at AAA. So you can probably expect him up. The Jays did claim another reliever arm to add to the 40 and option the minors in Luis Frias. They sent Yeri Rodriguez, not Nance, back down when Yenesis Cabrera came off the IL. So, you know, just a lot of churn there as well. Bo Bichette and Jordan Romano were around on the weekend. No material updates for them, really, but nice to see them around and checking in. Jake Bloss did make his first AAA start on Saturday through 2 2/3 innings, gave up 3 hits and a walk, didn't allow a run, only threw 50 pitches as they, you know, onboard him and check in where he's at and things like that. Nathan Lucas and Hagen Danner both started rehab assignments with Single-A Dunedin. Nathan Lucas maybe less so now with how many prospects they brought in and might want to get a look at. But Hagen Danner, if he can get back to the AAA level healthy by the end of this month, very much on the radar, I would think, for September. So interesting to keep an eye on that. Also, just a shout out, Rafael Sanchez, Kendry Rojas, Laz Estrada all had just awesome starts in the minor leagues over the weekend. So none of those guys remotely major league relevant yet, but for an organization that has not had a lot of pitching success of late, always nice when a bunch of fringier prospects are having having good performances at the same time. Again, it's Bowden Francis Davis Daniel. It's a 9:38 start. Ben Buck and Hazel on the TV call. Jamie and Caleb for Blue Jay Central. Eric and Chris on the radio. And Shy is down there. Ennis and Barker will have you four to six for the Blair and Barker spot. Show Ali will have you for the late night post game. We will be back at 10 a.m. tomorrow to break it down. Thank you to Keegan Matheson, Manny Randhawa, Brendan Wiley, and Sam Blum. Thank you to Amit Mon, who's back this week, Austin Mackey, and Jennifer Rolnick behind the glass. Hope you all have a wonderful Monday, and we'll talk to you tomorrow.